This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Most of us don't draw, or we think we don't. Oh, maybe you doodle during those long phone calls with your mother, or you sketch maps to help people find your house. But do you remember the last time you really tried to draw a picture of something? All of us did it as kids. Endless stick figures of parents and pets, idealized houses and landscapes. But at some point, most of us stopped. What happens to that impulse as we age? And why do some people continue to draw when there are cameras and computers that make it so much easier? In his new book, The Undressed Art, Why We Draw, author Peter Steinhardt explores the scientific and philosophical answers to those questions and examines the subculture of people who spend their afternoons and weekends sketching figure after figure in drafty art studios. Later in the hour, the U.S. military is looking for a talented accordion player. You must enjoy military music, be willing to travel, and maintain an excellent physical condition. If that sounds like you, the Air Force is waiting for your call. But now, Peter Steinhardt joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco to discuss the art of drawing. And we want you to join the conversation. If you draw for your hobby or profession, why do you keep doing it and what do you get out of it? If you stopped, why did you stop? And from models, too. Tell us about the experience on the other side of the gaze. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Peter Steinhardt, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you begin your book by talking about the fact that you were a naturalist, are a naturalist, and that for a long time you wrote about nature and the environment, but that somehow eventually led you back to drawing. How so? Explain that.
Well, drawing's very much like being a naturalist in that you're using your eyes and your own senses. A naturalist is simply somebody who's attentive, who's asking what things are and why they are, and an artist is doing the same thing, and what they really have in common is they're both ways of engaging personally and deeply with the world. You look long and hard at things, and you figure out what you think and feel about them. And it's a way of confronting the strangeness of the world and making it comfortable and familiar. You know, it's a way to get your heart and mind doing the same thing at the same time.
And at a certain point, you got tired of writing about nature and the environment.
Well, I'm not sure I'm tired of writing about nature and environment. This is just something that came up. The experiences are so similar that the more I thought about it, the more I could see the striking parallels. And the difference is that you don't have the wind in your face when you're doing this, and you're not sleeping on the ground when you're doing this. It's a different sort of circumstance, but very much the same engagement.
Yeah. And you talk also about a drawing as seeing, as opposed to going for making the perfect figure. You have to see it first.
Yeah, and I think that's the very hardest thing to learn about it is, we talk about the way children draw. They draw, they tend to draw symbols. They start at the age of two drawing a circle, and it evolves into a circle with some dots and smaller circles in it, and then rays expanding out from the circumference. And at about three to four, the rays diminish to two to four for arms and legs, and those dots diminish to a couple of circles for eyes and nose and mouth. And the very first pictorial thing a child does is a human. And it happens the same way in all children and all cultures. And they go on drawing this way, but what they're doing is drawing symbols. What happens as you grow older, you want to get more essence, more nuance, more detail, more of the emotional content into the drawing. And you have to learn to see over and over again. It's a common refrain among well-known artists. Also, the difficulty of seeing, I think what your question is pointing out also that there's a difference between what you're doing when you're drawing and what you're doing when you're making a picture. Slightly that when you're doing a painting, you tend to take what you've learned in drawing and arrange it. This is an undressed art in that it's your natural and fairly spontaneous vision of things.
Well, the way I thought of it, because frankly, I don't draw at all. I mean, I doodle perhaps, but I have no talent for it. But part of what you were saying, I understood from the perspective of a person who does interviews, as I'm doing on this program, which is that it's not just about asking questions, but about listening. And that was the way I kind of related to what you seem to be saying about drawing.
Yeah, it's very much a way of learning to participate in the world, of concentrating on things outside of you, of slowing things down. When you start drawing, you start looking at things slightly differently, and you take a lot longer time. You're trying to sort of figure out what are the essential parts of it, what are the essences of it that cause you to feel a certain thing, and you're trying to figure out your feeling, too.
Do we all draw as kids? I mean, I have to be honest and say I don't have lots of memories of drawing. I have memories of coloring things in and, you know, maybe some stick figures here and there. But it wasn't something that I did a lot of personally, although I have a child that does it all the time. Do you think we all did as kids and then stopped doing it at some point?
Well, the literature says that, and I, you know, my wife, who teaches second grade, has a room full of kids who are all doing it, and it may be, you know, especially those of us who become pretty adept at language. Often, what has happened is that the language has replaced it as mm-hmm. a way of interpreting the world, and it may be that you simply don't remember when you were fumbling around with a purely visual and non-linguistic intelligence. In the past. But what happens with most children is that at some point, as they are trying to interpret more and more of the world, the linguistic parts of the brain are growing much more rapidly, and they become much more effective at describing and containing and memorizing things. And at the same time, they're getting, of course, criticism from parents who are looking at their drawings and say, that doesn't really look like Aunt Agatha. And so you know, they're biting their tongues and saying, maybe I'll just talk about Aunt Agatha. So by about the age 9 or 10, the language centers of the brains have pretty much taken over for most of us. I think the big mystery is, why do about 10% of us keep on drawing?
Yeah. And why? Why do you?
I don't really have an answer for this, but I do see this pattern, and I think it was true with me that I think the best example that I can cite is John Ruskin, the 19th century, the Victorian writer, who grew up as an only child in a kind of very cold and conservative Scots family, and they did not permit him playthings or playmates, and he was off by himself all the time. And what he did was draw. He drew everything around him. He drew clouds and trees mm-hmm. and so on. And I think that he just developed a visual approach to things, and it made him quite original. And, you know, he grew up to shape the Victorian world's view of art and literature.
Yeah. It's interesting, this connection between nature and drawing. Again, a sort of personal anecdote, not for myself, but my daughter, who, as I said, loves to draw, was when we were on vacation at a lake, and she was about 2, and she was over there, and I thought she was just, you know, jotting things down, and I was going to see big splashes. And I went over, and there was something that clearly was representing a sun, and a storm was coming, and there was the lake was there, and I was amazed to see that she had actually done something that was really representative. But it happened in a quiet moment in a place where she was surrounded by nature and was just off on her own at a very young age.
It might be that independence is very much a part of this. It certainly is when you draw as an adult that you're taking a very personal view of things. And I think that's one of the, if there's a renaissance of drawing going on, I think that's probably one of the reasons that it's happening, is that it's harder and harder to experience things for yourself in life. The property is all pretty much owned and turned to commercial purposes. And most of the what you need to know is given to you in a highly mediated form. Sometimes it's colored by somebody else's political or commercial or psychological needs and so on. I think we all have a need to sort of figure things out for ourselves, to engage the world ourselves. And certainly nature, looking at nature and drawing are very much the same thing in that regard.
We're talking about drawing and why we draw with Peter Steinhardt. He's the author of The End Undressed Art, Why We Draw. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Michael, who is in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
Go right ahead.
Well, I'm an art therapist, and I find this topic real intriguing. I think my own experience in working with many patients is that drawing has a real therapeutic process to it. One thing is kind of interesting right now, I just had an article that's going to be appearing in the Art Therapy Journal about imagery in the county jails. And what I've discovered is when I went into the county jails is that a lot of people would use the image-making process as a way of coping with the jail environment.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
There's a lot of literature, a lot of study out now that seems to show that at-risk kids in schools who are given arts tend have a higher tendency to pull out of whatever is, you know, what is troubling them. They tend to do much better overall, grade-wise. They become socially more active and accept leadership roles and so on. There's clearly a lot that can be done with this as if you want to call this therapy.
Right. In fact, even like doing doodles as you're talking on the phone or things of that nature, all these kind of things I think have a therapeutic value to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks so much for your call, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
I'm just wondering, Peter, is there research on what happens in your brain when you draw?
It's very spotty and very tantalizing. Betty Edwards' book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, made much of the fact that there's a sort of right brain, left brain split. The left hemisphere of the brain is language-oriented. The right hemisphere is spatially oriented. And in most of us, the left hemisphere is quite dominant. And she taught drawing by doing exercises, which people have done for at least 100 years, turning off the left side of the brain so that the right side could take over. You do contours, you draw negative space. There's an exercise that Japanese painters used to use where you would bend over and look at the view upside down through your spread legs in order to try to see it. Anyway, there's this right brain, left brain thing where that has to do with shutting off language. But there's also some very tantalizing things. John Gabrielli at Stanford University and Robert Salzo at the University of Nevada put a well-known English portrait artist under an MRI scanner and sort of watched his brain as he drew. And then they put graduate students into the same scanner, people who had no art training, and watched their brains. And it was as if they were different organisms entirely. Different parts of their brains lit up. And it wasn't necessarily a right brain, left brain shift. One of the really interesting things was that the artist was far more active in the four brain areas that are concerned with concentration and focus. And what that suggests is that what is going on in the brain is that you're trying to coordinate many disparate areas of the brain. You're doing many different things at the same time when you're drawing, and a lot of what is going on is learning to rewire the brain so that these things fire in the right sequence and that you have control over them. Another evidence that this is so is that most artists who work at this for a while go into a kind of deep concentration. It's a little like Buddhist meditation, but it's obviously not the same thing because the Buddhist meditation, you lose your sense of space, and in drawing, you seem to enhance it. So probably it's a very different form of flow that is going on there. But many artists report this, that when they draw, they just simply lose track of time. They can draw for 3 hours and not know where the time went.
Interesting. We have a couple of emails here from people who sadly cannot draw, but I'm going to just read one here that's interesting. I am an art appreciator that cannot draw. Years ago, I expressed this frustration in what might be loosely defined as a haiku. And here it is. Year after year, bare winter branches remind me that I cannot draw. Kind of sad, huh?
kind of sad. But, I think that anybody can learn to draw, can be taught to draw. There are levels at which people really excel at it. But I think I've seen people in the studios who work at it, and they are able in time to draw recognizable portraits.
All right, we're going to talk more about some of those people that you've met in the studios when we return from a short break. If you'd like to join our conversation about the art of drawing, give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. According to Paul Cézanne, art is harmony parallel to that of nature. And Matisse declared, drawing is the precision of thought. So on the show today, we are talking about drawing, thought, and nature with Peter Steinhardt, the author of The Undressed Art, Why We Draw. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Just before the break, Peter, you were talking about some of the people you've met who many of them are in drawing clubs and drawing groups that you visited, I guess, as you were researching this book. And you say that there's sort of a ritual to what happens when artists get into a studio and begin to draw, particularly when there's a live model there. I wonder if you can just sort of take us through what it's like.
There are all kinds of these rituals. And again, it's sort of like watching Buddhist monks go into meditation, I think, in some ways. But this is a lot less formal. And people go into studios. They have favorite places to sit. The people who are drawing representationally will sit close. The people who are drawing more abstractly will sit farther away where they see the forms. And people go through periods before where they're sharpening their pencils and so on, and there are all kinds of little rituals that go into that. I think the big ritual is what happens when a model drops his or her robe in the center of the room, and you see these flickers of desire go around the room, and then you see these acts of appraisal. One of the models that I talked to said, you know, that I know that they're going nice, not so nice, and doing this kind of, how much does this person look like a fold out, and how much does this person not? But that all just almost instantly vanishes. The desire sort of cools out, and people start to draw, and it becomes something much more complicated and much more interesting at that point. And there's this high level of concentration, and there are a lot of really wonderful things that go on between artists and models in these sessions. They're not really ritualistic. They're one of the things that's highly rewarding about it.
Yeah, you describe the main attributes of a drawing group as, quote, nudity, desire, effort, and failure.
There's a lot of failure. It's a huge amount of effort for anybody who really gets serious about this. Drawing sort of creeps up on you when you start doing this. You get somewhat obsessed by it. Paul Valéry, the French critic and poet, said that conceivably drawing may be the most haunting obsession the mind can experience. People who do this have to do this every week to sort of keep those disparate parts of the brain talking to each other to keep the skills up. And mostly we do it as practice because we aren't selling what we're drawing there, and very few people want to put figure studies up on their walls. Most of it most of it ends up going in a recycling bin because it's disappointing. You know, you get a really good drawings are kind of supernaturally rare when you do this, but you keep at it and keep at it. And especially you keep at it because you have this, the sense that, that you're getting better. You're always getting better. And one of the things I found that was most interesting about this was the number of really great draftsmen who reported the same sense of futurity about it. And Degas said, you have to have a high conception, not of what you're doing, but what you may do one day. And without that, there's no point in working. And there's a wonderful quote by Hokusai at the age of 73. He wrote that, by the age of 6, I had a mania for drawing the form of things. By the time I was 50, I had published an infinity of designs, but all that I have produced before the age of 70 is not worth taking into account. At 73, I have learned a little about the real structure of nature, of animals, plants, birds, fishes, and insects. In consequence, when I am 80, I shall have made more progress. At 90, I shall penetrate the mystery of things. At 100, I shall have reached a marvelous stage. And when I'm 110, everything I do, be it a dot or a line, will be alive.
That's great. All right, we're going to take some calls now. We have Jeffrey in San Francisco on the line. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi. I'm a graphic designer in San Francisco and make my living as a drawer, basically. I started drawing as a kid and received encouragement and kept going. In art school, I'm remembering a developmental psychology class where we studied children's art, and the instructor maintained that when kids don't receive the encouragement, they stop drawing. And then if, as adults, they try to start drawing again, they're at the same level as where they left off. And my question is, if that is indeed true,
That's interesting. Or do you begin again where you started when you were eight, if you stopped at eight?
Yeah, Minerva Durham, who has taught drawing in New York City for more than 20 years, has a studio where people can come in and draw almost every day of the week, has said this to me, that she sees a lot of people who are starting out at the age of 40 or 45, and they come in and they draw exactly like eight-year-olds. And I find that I think you lay down some of these patterns, and I think that I find that if I'm not careful, some of the things that I was drawing when I was a kid creep out into the drawings now. Mm. I think you're learning line segments that work for you and motor patterns that work for you. And I think once you lay down those neural connections, they sort of keep their franchise forever, and you sometimes have to fight against them. If you're lazy or you're tired or you're not really working, suddenly you'll look down and you'll say, I'm drawing like somebody else today. and sometimes it's what you were drawing when you were pretty young.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Let's take a call from Marcy in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Marcy.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Lost you for a minute there. I'm calling. I have a degree in art. I don't really draw much anymore. And one of the reasons, I could sit down and draw something in front of me exactly as I see it. I could never duplicate it out of my imagination. I couldn't sit down with a blank canvas without a still life in front of me. And I was wondering if, you have that experience with other people, and if it's something that, that there is a crossover, that there's something to do to cross over into being able to do that.
Yeah, hi, Marcy, I'm going to ask you to just listen. We're having a little trouble with your phone, so if you just listen, hang up and listen to the answer on air. Thanks so much for your call.
There are people who I think can draw out of their imaginations wonderfully, and I'm not one of those people. I have to draw and draw and draw. I think it's one of the reasons that we go back to the figure so often. We want to draw it every week, and if you go through a drawing session, a single evening, I'll do at least a dozen different drawings, and there are some drawing sessions where they just do short poses for 3 hours, and you may come away with 150 different sketches of poses in an evening. And I think that the reason we do that is that the more we draw, the more we retain in memory, and the more we're able to produce from it without a model in front of us. There's certain things I can do now, I think, that I just out of mind, that I couldn't possibly have done 10 years ago, and before I was drawing really several times a week.
I have an email here I wanted to read to you. I grew up with a family of four boys. All of us enjoyed drawing when we were younger. My brother is a successful portrait artist in New York, while the rest of us languish in the world of stick figures. Why didn't his talent reach the rest of us? How much of his success is genetic, and how much is hard work?
I'd be willing to bet hard work counted for a lot. But again, since this is something that involves so many different parts of the brain, and there is so much incredible variety between brains, certainly some part of it has to be genetic. This is something I think is a great mystery. Why is it that some of us continue, some of us don't? It may be that we have neural connections already that make us more visual. And I do know some people who I think are kind of obliged to their visual senses, that they can only work out very complicated ideas visually. And then, of course, there is a line of evidence in autistic children who do not attain language at all but draw pretty phenomenally.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's certainly a big mystery, and it certainly would be lovely to see us watch brains develop and see what differs from people who become Van Goghs and what people are doing the stick figures.
Let's take a call now from Kevin in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. It's nice to be on your show.
Well, go right ahead.
I've been drawing since I was a kid, of course, but I find that I do some writing on the side, but drawing seems to be a way for me to express things that I can't. You mentioned language earlier that I just can't. You can't write it out. You can't speak it. And they're often enigmatic or symbolic, but they seem to be a one way to express things that you just can't get out any other way.
Clearly, that's why we do it. There are ideas that really don't lend themselves to language. very well. And you know, we humans have a variety of kinds of intelligences, and visual intelligence is one, linguistic intelligence is another. There are ideas that work out better in language, and there are ideas, I think, that work out better in pictures.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Kevin.
Thank you.
It's interesting to me because, again, I think of myself as a very verbal person. I mean, are they two different types of personalities, do you think, that you're talking about, those who draw and those who express themselves best through words or
language? There are people who do both quite well. Henry Miller was a drawer. Charles Bukowski was a drawer. There are a fair number of Tom Wolfe, who's a fabulous writer, is a pretty accomplished artist too. I don't know how we separate these things. I think you could probably develop both of these quite well. And of course, there are a lot of artists who are incredibly articulate. Reading Van Gogh's letters is quite something. He has tremendous insight into what he's doing, and he's extremely articulate about it. Matisse can be extremely articulate about it as well.
Well, you're talking about these great artists. I did want to ask you something that you touch on in your book is that drawing does not hold a particularly high place in the world of art these days. Is something that you mention in the book. Is that right?
Yeah, it's certainly been devalued by modernism for over the last 100 years at least. The development of photography is certainly one of the things that did that. Photography can capture images much more realistically and much more thoroughly than an artist can. And as it developed its technology, art had to retreat from... Artists sort of lost the role of being recorders of portraiture and recorders of historical event, and it's certainly one of the reasons that we moved into Impressionism, because artists could go into realms of color that photography could not follow, and then Cubism, because it could represent multiple points of view that a camera could not, and Surrealism, because it could go into psychological realms that the camera could not enter. But starting at mid-century, when abstract expressionism came in, it came in with such a vengeance that there was a kind of ideological bent against people doing anything representational at all. And drawing became much more marginalized and sometimes even disappeared from the art education programs. At the same time, other forms of art, conceptual art, video art, installation art, those kinds of things have attained a greater role in art. So we had in the 1960s a point in which there was very little drawing going on in much of the country because of this. And it's still something that the debate still runs through the art studios. You still have people who are basically abstractionists kind of disparaging the realistic art, and you have people who are realists still fighting a kind of rear guard action saying, no, this is the real art. And there's a lot of debate about this.
Peter Steinhardt is the author of The Undressed Art, Why We Draw. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take a call now from Philip in Oakland, California. Hi, Philip.
Hello. I design for a living, and mostly residences, and I've done some... I've done some chair design and different invention directions I've gone with it. And I worked for a period of time in on computer in the early 80s and enjoyed that aspect of it, but went back to just graphite and freehand and the old traditional parallel rule. And I'm just wondering... Now that architecture students and most students are now learning drawing on the computer, how that's affecting creativity and how the more standard avenues of drawing affect creativity. Personally, myself, I feel like I'm more creative using my hand.
I share that. As a writer, I like to write longhand rather than use a computer on the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly this is true. Illustration and design has gone so heavily to the computer, and that usually, an awful lot of that at least, is simply buying stock photographs and then altering them on computer terminals. And so it's going to be a different kind of vision of the world that you get out of that than you get when you're working with a fine pointed drawing implement and thinking things out as you go in that way. And I'm not sure that this ends creativity, but I suspect myself that it changes the nature of creativity in some way. I don't know how exactly, but
For me, there seems to be a direct connection between when I'm conceiving something, and when I work on a computer, there's a distance from the object. It becomes a much more rational process, and when I'm actually drawing, the connection seems to be, I don't know, it just feels more creative, and it also, I have the advantage of if I have any kind of instrument, a pencil, anywhere I am, I can just pick it up and work on a thought that comes to mind. I don't have to have a computer with me.
All right. Thanks for your call, Philip.
Sure.
Let me just read you this email that came in. This will be the last thing you can respond to before we have to leave. I used to draw all the time. I was insatiable. Something happened, though. I lost that part of myself. I spent 2 years at College of Art cursing and bellowing and venting frustration that my hand could not create what my mind's eye willed it to do. I dropped out, finally, convinced once and for all that skill and talent are two entirely different things. However, in fits and in starts, I take it up again. I know that with time, with practice, with patience, my hand could create what my mind wills it to, but I worry that those neurological channels are clogged forever. I miss the triumph of the little line, the moment in a drawing that is it, the one nanosecond that contains the expression truly of what I mean. That's what I look for.
That's pretty fabulous.
That about sums it up, eh?
Yeah, I mean, that's Hokusai, that's Degas, that's Toulouse-Lautrec. That's the history of art, maybe, right in there.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Peter Steinhardt. You got a really interesting discussion about drawing going here for us today.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Steinhardt is the author of The Undressed Art, Why We Draw. He joined us from KQED in San Francisco. And when we come back from a short break, the Marines may need a few good men, but today the Air Force is only looking for one in particular, an accordionist. Want to apply for the job? Well, you can give us a call at 800-989-8255. And we'll also take your questions and comments about accordions in general and accordions in the military specifically. Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.